chillin', Anna. You were here about the eliminating of the negative and an accent on a positive.
Gather round me, chillin', if you're willing, and sit tight while I start reviewing.
Test. Is this thing on? Oh, yes, it is. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast, The Joyful Frugalista. And now here's your host, Serena Bird and friends.
Hello, Frugalistas, and welcome. Today I have a very good friend of mine, a new friend, but a good friend. And sometimes it's like that in life. You meet someone and you really connect and you find out you've got all these shared friends in common and shared interests in common. So welcome, Jen.
Well, thank you very much, Serena, for having me.
Jen Sederholm has, have I pronounced your surname properly?
Sederholm, very good.
Bit hesitant, I know, but there you go. So Jen Sederholm has a really interesting background. She has a long background in radio. She's coming up this month with your 20-year anniversary at 2CC.
Not at 2CC, but 20-year anniversary in radio.
And loves radio, loves podcasting. And she's also running a series of how to podcast courses throughout Australia, including here in Canberra in Goulburn. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. In her career, she's an announcer, a producer, a music historian, loves music, a sports commentator and a newsreader. She's also part of the Raiders core team for 2CC, which is something my Neil and my boys as massive Raiders supporters are very excited about. Welcome.
Thank you.
Radio. What is so special about radio? I remember listening to Queen and this whole Radio Gaga and this sense back in the 80s with MTV that radio was going to die. But it hasn't, has it?
No, it hasn't. In fact, I'll come back to this in a moment because right now is radio's halcyon days, unexpectedly. But for me, when I was younger, I grew up with a love of 60s music in particular, and all I retained was music artists and their backgrounds, and it was what I loved. It was my hobby when I was a kid. And so all I wanted to do basically was become a radio announcer. But when I finished school, my father said to me, oh, you better have a backup plan. He put it in different words than that. So I went to university and got a psych degree, which I've never used. But when I finished that psych degree, I went to TAFE and I got a music business diploma. And once I finished that, I got some work experience in radio. I did a radio course and I got in almost immediately after that, and I've really never looked back. We all want to know what we're meant to do in life, and for a long time, because there was always the backup plan, and I suppose you can't really, as a woman in this industry as well, sort of sit there and say, I'm a radio announcer and this is what I am. But right here and right now, this has been the love of my life, my whole life, and I feel very fortunate to work in the industry. But going back to your previous question about that Buggles song about video killing the radio star, it dawned on me the other day that with the bushfires over the Christmas period, with smoke and flood and drought, and now with this virus situation that we're all in at the moment, what is left for us is audio. If we're all isolated, and if, let's say, all the newsreaders on television can't go out and do their jobs, etc., when we had the fire situation, you had people who had no internet connection for months.
That's right. And all they had was radio. That was keeping them informed of some things that were potentially life-threatening, that were life-threatening.
They were indeed. And we, in our industry, release the top 100 podcasts every month, roughly. And over that, as you can imagine, December, January period, whereas normal content podcasts are right up there, but it was news-focused, as you can imagine, because people wanted to know what was happening here in Australia. And so really, this is a wake-up call to our industry, my industry, podcast industry, as to the value of our product when we don't have an alternative. It's hit home how important radio still is.
It is still important. And I think too, as people are becoming busier, that having the time to sit down and read is becoming harder and harder. So people do listen to things as they're commuting, as they're in their car, as they're on the train. So I think that's why that appetite for podcasting particularly has happened too. And I know for me, I mean, I love reading, but, you know, I'm a mother of two. I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of things. So often the only time that I've really got to think is while I'm cooking dinner, and that's when I listen to podcasts.
I understand that too. And for you and I personally, I had that real moment as the coronavirus was coming up, and with your Frugalista podcast, this is a moment where a lot of people sit there thinking, what do I need to do? What do I need to prepare? And being a long-term frugalista like yourself, these are things I was thinking about 3 weeks ago. in terms of, I don't want to say stockpiling because I'm really hating that buzzword at the moment.
I'm hating that too. Being prepared.
Yes, being prepared.
Being prepared.
And part of actually being a frugalista is that you're always sort of prepared in a different way. It's just been my life. It's my mother's life. I rang my mother, who is the queen of frugalistas. She is the doyenne of frugalistas. And I actually rang her to say, how are you for toilet paper? And I knew the answer.
Like, she was fine?
She said to me, I have 48 rolls. It's just her and dad. And I was like, she's fine.
She's fine.
That was the answer to everything. I know that everything is fine. She's going to have a massive freezer. She could last a year.
That's pretty good. We were actually running low, and it had been on my to-do list for about a week or two before all of this sort of happened, to go to Costco and get another bulk roll, you know, pack. It's not a roll. It's a, I don't know how many hundred rolls. There's a lot in there in a Costco pack. And we went then looking, I think about two weekends ago, and we're like, the toilet paper must have moved. This was before it was in the news. It must have moved. And we were wandering around Costco going, where's the toilet paper moved? And eventually Neil asked, and no one could find it anywhere. And no one had an answer at that stage in terms of where it had all gone. So we weren't too bad. We were down to eight rolls. And then a friend sold me her, who gives a crap, toilet paper, sold me a box. So we're fine now. But if we had been the sort of people who had gone down to our last roll, well, we probably would have done wee wipes or found a way, but it would have been hard, wouldn't it?
It would have been hard. And these are just when this is now starting to look like we are going to have periods of isolation. These are the kind of things that I feel like I've been prepped for my whole life in a strange way via just being that type of person ahead of time, so that I actually don't feel stressed about it. I just know whatever happens, we'll be fine.
Well, in a way, in Canberra, we did a lot of isolation in January anyway, because there were days on end where we couldn't go out because of the smoke haze. So we're probably a little bit prepped for that already. And we survived. We were resilient. We got there.
Yeah, we were resilient. But that was also an exercise for me in how important, again, my job was. And in that, I was frightened in that period, whereas this time around I'm strangely more relaxed. But on those very worst fire days when I was going into work and I wasn't sure how things were going to play out, that was when I was actually quite afraid of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, when that message was so important.
So what sort of things were you telling people? What were the key messages you were telling your listeners?
For a lot of people, it was just to basically stay by the radio. So Georgina Whelan, that remarkable woman we have out the front of our ESA, was doing updates. And, I mean, I can't provide that information. I'm in no way in the situation. So we'd go to Georgina Whelan. And one of the big things then was just because this was when people were going down to the south side of Canberra just to have a look at the fire.
Oh, yes, the disaster tourists.
Yes.
To get the good picky.
Yeah, so
first
that was
Instagram.
Actually the biggest message I was just saying of just why. Why would you do this? This was the hottest day of the year, the one where we weren't sure what was going to happen and yet people were
the
still going down.
The 42 degrees day.
Yeah. And so, yes, that was the biggest thing I was saying is just stay home. Don't put yourself at risk under any circumstances. And that's what the ESA was saying as well. But, yes, some people.
Yeah, people don't listen. Neil, who's sitting across from me, is an RFS, Rural Fire Service volunteer, and he was away for most of it in Spain, which I was quite happy about because he's away from the fires. But it was also hard because his immediate community where his parents still are was threatened, and it is difficult. But he knows and he sees, like, people behave in oddly irrational ways. There's a roadblock and people are desperate to get past the roadblock. And it's like, well, there's a roadblock for a reason.
Mm.
You can't get past because it's dangerous to go beyond this. And it is difficult because people are often fearful about their stuff and losing their stuff. But it's sad when they put their lives ahead of their stuff.
Yes, and it also brings perspective on people who are desperate to flee their country for very valid reasons, that pack mentality, we must get out. I worked for Aldi. Mm-hmm. I worked for Aldi for a couple of years. I was a store manager. And I have a...
Sounds like a dream job to me.
It was. I have learnt a lot behind the scenes that I know about that company, in a good way, I'm going to say, that I carry with me every time I still shop in there. But anyway, we had this one day, and you'll know with Aldi, they have their weekly specials. There's a very funny meme going on around. I don't know if you've seen it about how Woolworths has the one toilet paper rule, Coles has the one toilet paper rule, but Aldi has the one meerkat statue, one trumpet, one whatever it is rule, because Aldi's just different to everything else. Anyway, this particular day, it was baby week. So that was the cot and everything. We had this massive queue at the door for 9 o'clock to open the doors. At the very front of the queue was this little old lady with her nose pressed against. And you could see all these men and women getting ready to run as soon as the door opened. So We were sitting there looking at this little old lady, and we were placing bets on what baby item she was trying to get. It must have been for the grandkids, etc. So the doors open. Everyone runs for the cots and the mattresses. That was the very desirable. We only had that.
And the rocking chairs. The rocking chairs are huge.
Oh my gosh, yes. This little old lady gets her bread and her milk, runs to the counter to get first with her bread and milk, and stands there as smug as anything. And it's that pack mentality. She was like, well, if everyone else is running to get in, I don't think she was even noticing it was baby week, but she had to get her bread and milk first. And I've never seen anything like it. We laughed so much at this woman's intensity to get her bread and milk.
Well, it's funny because my dad rang me yesterday and he was in a bit of a panic about the thing that shan't be named that's going around at the moment. And he gets up early every morning and goes for a walk to do his shopping. And he said yesterday morning he'd been just after opening, and apparently they'd said that as soon as it opened, the supermarket opened at 7:30, the shop assistant said it was just like this stampede to get in to buy the toilet paper and everything else. Mm. And he found it quite funny because that's just part of his normal routine. But I guess what's going to happen in a couple of months, like everyone's got their supplies, are they then not going to go shopping for a while? Are the supermarkets going to be overrun with stocks of toilet paper because factories have gone into overdrive to produce and we're going to have too much? I mean, there's a certain amount you can use, right? There's a limit.
Yeah, there is. But I do think it's just with the supermarkets will return to business quickly. It's small business that's going to perhaps never bounce back.
And are you seeing that through your work at 2CC?
I am seeing it in terms of people's fears, and I'm seeing it in terms of my podcasting courses because people are looking for new ways to promote their business. And, of course, that's what is great about podcasting. It's cost effective. It's a new way of doing it. You can put together online packages that you can release to your captive audience to check out your product, whatever it is. So I think that me personally, I'm in a really wonderful situation to have a product that really helps small business, but it's going to be, well, we're going to potentially, if we're all in isolation, we're going to have plenty of time to get across that, to be able to use those sort of tools while we are in isolation.
Getting prepared once again.
Mm.
So someone wanting to be prepared to launch their own podcast, how do they go about it? I mean, I meet so many people, I guess because I'm a writer and a podcaster myself. I feel like every week I meet someone who says, oh, Serena, I really need to talk to you because I really want to get into podcasting. And I'm sure you meet a lot of people like that through your courses. What are the first things that people should consider or could consider when they're thinking about podcasting?
Clarity of their idea, first and foremost. People come in with an idea that's usually too broad and not sustainable as a result. So you have to be very clear about what your product is that you're selling and then who your audience is. And so many times, this is part of the exercises I will do, is like, who is listening to your podcast? Now, we just had a chat off air about who's listening to your podcast, and you are very clear with, you'll get people outside of your peak market, absolutely, but you're very clear with who you have listening to you.
I've got a pink logo.
Absolutely. And I'm with my 2040 podcast, I pretty much have a pink logo too. We know my podcast is for women. I might get men listening from time to time, but it's a women's podcast. And interestingly for me, I'm digressing slightly here. I thought it would be for my generation more than Kirsty, my podcast partner, who's in her early 20s. But the people who actually listen are more Kirsty's generation, which I find fascinating. And anyway, but that's been a learning curve for me. But I, in my classes, I'll naturally say to a person, who's your podcast for? And the bog standard answer is everyone.
Yeah, and you do need to drill that down a bit. And just to go back, I must say that I love your 2040 podcast. If you do nothing else, look up now on, if you're on iTunes or if you're on Podbean or Spotify, look up Jen's podcast 2040. So it's a conversation between a woman in her 20s and a woman in her 40s about a whole range of issues affecting women.
And that we have more in common than you think. I think that many people, and Kirsty hates the word millennials.
Does she? I don't blame her.
Yeah, it gives
They've
a connotation.
They've been so misaligned.
That is exactly right. And they're so smart and they're so engaged. And they're, for me in my 40s, where I would not speak up on issues at work that I wish I could have if I had my time over, they're so much more engaged. And so I've got so much out of the relationship with her that I think we all could benefit from with having a friend who's a millennial like what I have with Kirsty. But Yeah, so lesson wise for people who start a podcast is the third thing critically is that you don't buy all the stuff the first day you start podcasting, because people want to go out and buy all the bells and whistles. And mm-hmm. there's always someone who'll sell you all the bells and whistles plus more than what you need.
I have met so many people like that, two to date, really. And I don't even know if they know what they're buying.
No. And so therefore my other bit of advice is just get yourself the basics, and then it's the 7 podcast itch. When you get to the 7 podcast, you'll know if you're going to continue with it. And so many people drop off at that, around that 7 podcast point, where it just gets, you realize how much effort, you realize how much time and editing, and presumably you're editing, because that your starting point, podcast 1, is a whole lot different to series 3, podcast 1. So that's some of the key messages, along with the editing. That editing is not as daunting as people think it is.
Well, I'm saying yes, it's really easy because my husband Neil does the editing. He's laughing. He's very good at it. That said, though, in the context of relationship, I'm very aware of the time commitment he makes to do that and the impost it is on him. So it is definitely something to consider. I mean, some people outsource editing. That's the way they deal with that. But then there's a cost that's involved. But then if you write an article, that takes time. I mean, I'm a writer, so naturally it's in some ways easier and quicker for me to write. But for a lot of people, it's actually easier and quicker to podcast.
Mm, yes, I'm similar to you. I love writing as much as I love podcasting, and I find both about as easy when I'm in my zone.
Yes, when you're in your zone. That's the keywords.
It is absolutely the keywords. But coming back to podcasting too, this is the other thing that I try and put out to people who are doing the courses and people who are listening to you today, is that audiobooks come with a money cost.
They do.
We all know that. You go into buying an audiobook knowing you're buying it. Podcasting is still, as a general rule, mostly free to access, download, etc. So people are creating a free product at this point in time. And the hard thing for people who go into podcasting wanting to make money out of it is that usually you start with this free product you're making, and then you want to get people to subscribe or something like that. And when you get to that point, it's really hard to keep people on board unless you have a massive base of fans, because why would they buy it? The old slang saying, why would you buy the cow when you're getting the milk for free? And especially if it's on a certain topic. So you're doing this fantastic podcast. I'm going to use yours hypothetically on being a frugalista.
Fabulous.
Fantastic that you should be listening to. And then you put a $10 subscription onto it. Do people then go, well, I'll just see if I can find that message somewhere else for free?
It's a hard call. I don't know, but especially in my niche where I do talk about frugalista living, I'm conscious that a lot of my listeners, firstly, are very money savvy and they want to save money. And then secondly, they might not have so much money as they build up. So it is a hard call.
It's a very difficult call. And it's the one that podcasting across the board is going to have to find an answer for. I mean, it's booming. But that's why there is that drop-off, because you get to a certain point of time when you've committed all this time for free, or you're outlaying money, and you need a return for it. However, the benefits for business, for instance, if you are still committing to making it and editing it and putting it up on your business channels, I mean, you're getting the return if it's working for you, bringing people into your business. So there's that trade-off. But a lot of those conversational style podcasts are the hardest to sustain.
It's an interesting perspective. In my case, and actually someone asked me this a couple of days ago, and I really had to think about it, what were my reasons for podcasting? And they were many. A key one is because I'm just genuinely really passionate about the message, about financial resilience. And I feel now with all the crises we've seen this year, of which there's been many, particularly in Canberra and now globally, and as the economy teeters on the brink of recession, I feel that this message of financial resilience is more important than ever. So I'm deeply passionate about this, and any way that I can outreach to people about this importance and to build that community and awareness is it's gold to me. But also too, I guess I want to get people used to hearing my voice and seeing if they align with my values, because I also offer money coaching services. So that's a good way in terms of content marketing that people can see if that's the sort of approach that would gel with them, without me sort of hitting them in the face with overt advertising that's probably not going to be as it resonate in the same way. And plus, I get it's a lifelong learning thing. I get to meet people like you and to learn amazing things. So it's part of the journey for me.
I could not agree more. And that's also why I've gone into the training aspect of it too, because every single class I have, there is someone in there that at a point later on I'll probably feature in a podcast. And every single class, someone brings to me an idea or an angle that I would not have got to myself.
Mm.
And that is part of lifelong learning. And I love teaching so much unexpectedly because that's what I get out of it every single session. But the thing also with podcasting, and I mean, this 20 years of media now too, is that you can never stop promoting yourself. But there's smart ways of doing it where you don't bash someone over the head with your message because no one engages with that. I recoil when I feel like I'm being flogged a message. So it's the diversity of approach, and that's also what I'd bring into voiceover and into podcasting, is that you go into podcasting sometimes, and I was talking about how broad people think it is, but you do have a tunnel vision as to all that you can be, and it's about thinking about the different options as to ways you can expand or you can be as well.
I think well said, there's a lot of reasons to podcast, and there's a lot of different things you can get out of it.
Mm.
I'd actually like to ask you another question now, which is to talk a little bit about your upbringing. And you referred to your super frugal mum before. What lessons did you learn about frugality from your mum?
My mum rocks, first and foremost. She is just the most amazing human being. I was brought up, we weren't poor. We were very middle class. And my mother never worked, my dad only worked. And I loved everything that my mother did in terms of op shopping, because I was always part of that journey, and how she shopped. And my mother said to me, "You're going to hate grocery shopping once you have kids." I remember her saying this to me, and I still love grocery shopping. She was wrong on that one.
I love grocery shopping too.
Oh, see, I could have guessed that in you. I get real joy out of it. I could never shop online because the pleasure of going into the stores and getting a bargain fills me with pleasure, as does op shopping. But anyway, it was about 12, I had a friend come over to my house, and she was the first person who kind of basically said to me, she implied that we were poor, and I'd never seen it or thought it or anything like that beforehand. But because we had lots of op shop stuff and bargain hunted and shopped that way, I just thought that was how families did it. And so she put into my mind that perhaps there was some shame associated with that way of living.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really pleased that it didn't stop me. But around the same time, I had a different girl at school who'd seen, I'd been out with my mum and my brother, and we'd been collecting aluminium cans. Like, we'd been picking them up so we could get some money from collecting them, like what they do now regularly.
Like what they do now, like what my boys now. It's super trendy now, and it's environmental, and it's hip.
It is now. But she saw my family doing this to get some money from the aluminium cans, and she called me for years Jennifer Dig in a Bin.
Jennifer Dig in a Bin.
Yes.
That's very friendly, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't think she was being funny. I think she actually was being offensive and rude, as teenagers can be.
I don't think that was nice, sorry.
Yeah.
I can't see anything nice in there.
But it's amazing the shame then that you have those two things put together over what has been just an elemental part of your life. However, as I said, I've never allowed that shame to stop me, but it did mean that when I had certain friends over, I would never go out op shopping with mum, or I would tell mum in the supermarket, "Oh, don't buy the reduced one." And all these things that all of a sudden that I had not contemplated as being any big deal beforehand. Anyway, of course, now I have two children of my own. And I have a son who has a penchant for soccer jerseys, like different teams. He wants as many countries, as many different jerseys as possible. Now, these jerseys, new, are $160.
Wow.
However, his great joy at the moment is when we go out op shopping, he always checks. And he's now got 30 jerseys, and we have a $10 cap, right? If it's more than $10, we don't buy it. So we've got 30 jerseys from op shops for under $10 in his wardrobe, to this massive array, and he wears them with such pleasure and delight, and he can't wait to go op shopping with me. And I really like that, because he also, when we go out shopping, is the first person to say, "Hey, if we get something," he's like, "Is it on special?" "Oh, well, I'll get a different variety that is on special."
So they've got that awareness from an early age about the importance of cost.
But for him also, the pleasure of getting a bargain and that he goes to school wearing the jersey that he loves. And in his head, he's like, this cost me $8 at Vinnie's, but my mates bought it for $160 from Rebel.
And he knows that difference. I do think our consciousness is changing now as we're becoming more aware about sustainable fashion, about the need for ethically produced clothing and environmentally friendly clothing, that this stigma about shopping in op shops is changing. And the quality of what is stocked in most op shops is changing too, because people aren't donating their worn out old stuff. They're donating almost brand new things. In some cases, they are brand new that still have labels on them.
That's Canberra.
This is Canberra.
I was so surprised when I first came here because I had come a trajectory via Brisbane, via Sydney, where op shopping is very different. I'd go into Canberra and I'd look at the labels and the brands and think, what's going on here that they're giving this stuff that's new or near new away? And it's because we are such a transient but exactly. affluent society. So op shopping here is like nowhere else in Australia.
And you get all those very fashionable people from the embassies who come over. Sometimes I see the most amazing European brands and I was like, well, how does it get here? And then I'm like, oh, yeah, embassies. And there's one op shop in particular on the south side. And when I went in there, I was like, wow, how come they've got all these amazing brands? And then I realised that they are in that catchment where a lot of people who live in the embassies, who work in the embassies, live in that area. And so when they finish their postings and they don't want to take things back, they donate them and it often ends up in that particular op shop.
We're going to have to go together.
We're going to have to go op shopping.
I have a question for you, and it's really I have always wanted to ask you this, and I wonder if someone's asked you this on air. But when I op shop, I never op shop with any thought that I'll sell it on eBay later. I actually feel really yuck about people who do that sort of thing. What's your take on the people who op shop to on sell?
That's actually a really interesting question, because on Friday night, one of my friends who I met at the Zonta Pre-Love fashion sale was talking about how she regularly flips and sells things. I don't have a problem with it. In fact, my sister had been toying with the idea about selling secondhand things. I haven't personally, and it's mainly just a time factor, to be honest. But I think sometimes when you understand brands and you understand clothing, and it's about how you curate it as well. Not everyone has the time to go op shopping. If you have things beautifully curated and often you're doing mending and you're presenting it in a different way, and say you're at a market stall and then people come along and you've got that art too of connecting them with that clothing that suits them. So there is a value add to them as well.
There is, and that's the different factor of what you were just saying about the when you buy something and you upgrade it and sell it. So what I have seen quite a lot of lately is people haggling over the price of something in an op shop to on-sell it as it is. But I think the upgrading is a great concept, and I wholly embrace. It's just the when they're coming in and they're saying, I'll pay this amount for you for this product, and then they're on-selling it as it is. I have some reservations about that internally probably justifiable reason, but I suppose because I op shop differently.
Like I said, it's not something I've done myself, but it is something that I've wondered sometimes whether I could do, mainly because I'm trying not to op shop so much, but I do still op shop a lot. And I know what I like and I know what I'm looking for, because not everyone understands brands or understands quality. And I have an interest in, like I said, connecting things with people that look good on people, and I know often with my friends instinctively what their style might be or what might look good on them. Part of my joyful giving journey this year has been doing that. Like often I'll have friends rock up and I'll say, I have the dress for you, and they'll go, no, I don't need anything. And I said, no, just try it on and it'll be right. So I'm quite interested in that aspect of it.
Yeah, me too.
And then I think for some people too, as things become tough financially, they are going to be looking for different side hustles and different things that you can do. And not everyone has the time to go op shopping in a suburban Canberra store if they live, say, in Melbourne or Sydney or a remote country town, but they want a particular dress by a particular brand for a particular reason. The friend I met on Friday night told me about how there's this whole Facebook group for Q items, for instance. There's some people who really love that brand and they really want, you know, historical and retro pieces, and they may not be able to find that right piece in a right store.
Yep, that's fair enough too. And I also do get that because, funnily enough, I have a friend who's an event loves event dresses, and so whenever I see it, I'll pick them up. But I suppose I'm of the joyful giving. If I find it and I buy it, I will pass it on as a gift rather than a purchase. But then I suppose that's my mentality to the frugalista lifestyle. The other thing I have to add is that I am doing the same thing as you, and I'm not new buying this year.
You're not new buying any clothes this year?
Correct.
You are about my third friend that I know that is doing this, and I'm both delighted and horrified because it means it's harder for me to give things away.
Well, that's not new items. You've just given me a lovely pair of trousers today that is bought, but I haven't purchased anything with it. So
you haven't purchased?
No, but see, I'll buy secondhand. I'm still going to buy secondhand clothing. I'm just not buying anything new.
Just not buying anything new.
Yeah.
Well done on that. Now, before we go, I would like to ask you for a frugalista tip. Do you have a favourite frugal tip?
When you go op shopping, don't go in looking for something.
Don't go in looking for something.
Because if you go in looking for something specific, you'll never find it.
So it's very much a hunting, gathering approach to op shopping.
I find that all the time. I have friends in my life, and I bet you're the same. I have this whole list of things that they want me to find one day. If I ever see this in an op shop, get this for me. And there is no greater buzz than the day when you do walk in unexpectedly and you find that item that they've asked you to see if you can find in an op shop. So I usually go into an op shop with no clear outline of what I'm looking for. And that is the pleasure in op shopping for me.
That is lovely. I just love that. And I'm looking at my husband. Yes, I'm looking at you. See, you go into an op shop without an actual goal. And it means you can buy lots. No, I didn't say that. I'm frugal. Thank you very much, Jen. It's been a pleasure having you on here today. Now, how can people find you?
So podcast-wise, I have 2040, which you can find via Facebook, Instagram, and we're on Spotify, Apple. I have to get
Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts and iHeartRadio, all of those good channels. You can hear me on 2CC on regularly and the Raiders call team if you're Canberra-based. And teaching-wise, my new website is Jen, as in J-E-N, X Audio, and you can find out about all my courses there.
Lovely. I'll make sure to put that into the show notes when I publish this podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to The Joyful Frugalista with Serena Bird. She actually likes everybody. And of course, sound has been by Neil Hadley. And myself, I'm Joseph McGrail Baitup.
You gotta accentuate the positive feeling, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.